Guys, this is episode 53 of the Operators Podcast, and this week we are going to talk about Temu. What is going on with Temu? How are they growing so fast? What does it mean? How should we be protecting ourselves and our businesses from competition? We're going to wrap on that with Matt and Jason. Sean is off this week. Who knows what he's doing? Probably dreaming up the next big product launch. So thanks for joining us. This is episode 53. So as anybody who listens to the show knows, having an ERP solution is an absolute must as you grow. There's just no other way to stay organized. What you may not know about having an ERP, and I've personally experienced, is that over 50% of ERP implementations fail. I cannot overstate how much money has been spent, has set on fire and spent trying to set up an ERP only to lead into frustration. So that's why it's so important that you make the right choice for your business when you're thinking about implementing an ERP, and why Fulfill is one of the sponsors of the podcast. When it comes to running an e-com business, Fulfill is a fantastic solution that was designed for businesses that are primarily digital. We personally have gone through, I've gone through three ERP implementations in my career, and I've seen how doing it the right way is a big part of success. But the other big part of success is picking a partner whose tool is really built for your company and what your company does. So if you're a listener to this podcast and you have an e-commerce focused business, Fulfill is an excellent option to be checking out for your ERP solution.
Mike, are you running for governor? You're late. What's the deal?
Yeah. Sorry, guys. You know, speaking engagements. No, I was picking out tile for my pool across town, and I got stuck in traffic. So
I don't believe that one bit.
Guys, we are in the falling action of a home build here. So it's an exciting time.
But I do think there's a case that Mike is actually gearing up to run for governor of Oklahoma, and we just don't know it. You know, either that or you were doing a one-on-one in the gym. I'm not sure.
Guys, listen, that's the entire point of doing this podcast. I feel like I can start to build a groundswell by winning the e-commerce crowd and then parlay that into political fame.
And you're just going to be president? Is that the, like, the 20-year, we can go from drinkware to presidency?
Man, I'll just say this. I don't know how anybody, like, looks at politics and is like, that seems like a great lifestyle, you know?
Right. Here's why. Number one, they're often a narcissist. And number two, they see dollar signs. But I'll say if anyone on the pod were to run for office, it should be Mike Beckham. I do think that he has like the most integrity of everyone on the pod.
Look at all the family photos behind him.
What in the world? This turned into like quiet. Can I use this footage? Jason, I'm hiring you. You're going to be my publicist.
Jason's the pump man. That's what he is. He's the man. Beckham pumper.
I'm the Mikey hype man.
To your note about narcissists, I have a friend who was connected to Paul Ryan. And, you know, he was a VP candidate 1 year. And they asked him if he would ever run for president. And he said, no, you have to be a raging narcissist, in my experience, to run for that office.
Wow. I mean, that's honest.
I'll tell you guys one other story. I was talking to a sitting congressman, and he said at one point in 2020, they brought in a personality. Maybe I've shared this before. They brought in a personality expert, and they did personality profiles of a bunch of world leaders. And Trump and Xi were a couple of them that they did. And there were three different kind of things they scored them on. And one of them was narcissism. And both Trump and Xi were 10s out of 10. In this test assessment, like whatever knocking the top off the test of narcissism was, they did it.
But there's something also about being really successful and really wealthy that it does go to your head. And it amplifies a lot of this stuff, because I know a lot of people like that. And, you know, we're surrounded by successful, wealthy people in our lives. And when you meet the one that's like really quiet quiet success and quiet money. I think that's really impressive. I think it's actually really hard to do. It's like so tempting to flex. And this actually kind of is somewhat related to a Panthers and that I want to do later. But in any event, these guys are all narcissists and you aren't, Mike. And that's exactly why you should run for office. You have my vote.
I love it.
So I have a theory on this, Jason, on the dynamic you were just talking about. Here's my theory. Obviously, to some extent, to be successful, you've got to have kind of almost irrational self-confidence. You've got to be a pretty talented person usually. But what happens is, as you become more and more successful, the people around you, the entourage, the people that work for you, whatever, they have a pretty vested economic interest in you liking them. And so as a result, the willingness, unless you really are intentional in developing friendships and being somebody who really solicits feedback, they have no incentive to share with you the rough edges and the ways that you need to grow or get better. They have no incentive to hold you accountable when you act like a child, and because they want you to like them. And so this is actually this hidden kind of tax on being successful, is that the more successful you are, the more that people walk into interactions with you just thinking, I just want them to have a good impression. And that we have to get this kind of feedback and reciprocity from people in order to understand when we're off course, when we have a big blind spot, you know, when people think we're being ridiculous or whatever, and people stop giving us that. And so you basically have to hold yourself accountable at a level that's just like a totally different level to continue to have high character. Or to your point, Jason, you've got to find other people that have been really successful that aren't going to be impressed by what you've done, but have a similar, are trying to walk a similar path. And I do think this has been one of the things that I've appreciated about being around you guys and the group of guys and gals that we are kind of running with in the e-com world, is they've been successful, but there's real humility. They don't take themselves too seriously. You know, and they want to figure out how to get better. But generally, I don't think that's how most people are. I think as you get more successful, you just want people to kind of feed your ego, and people are more than happy to do it. And, you know, you look up. I don't think, like, for example, I don't think Hollywood celebrities want to become the people they turn into, right? I think that there's got to be some of that that is not just underlying narcissism, but it's also like the environment you get in when you become really successful.
Didn't you once say this on a pod, or did I dream this, about how like people get really, maybe, oh, you know what? I think it was Elon, but we talked about it. Like, you basically, when you reach a certain level of success, then you almost want to destroy yourself.
Yeah.
Like, I think that is that's kind of related.
I think no matter what, Jason, you know, it's funny. In any success, at least in my experience through life, like through this journey, all the way up the food chain, right? Is that when you meet somebody who is humble and has a bit of humility and they're like low key successful, they probably took a trip around the asshole sun at some point. Like their ego probably it caught up to them. And then they were like, I don't like this person. And then they went and took a left turn and got back to like whatever they were. Cause you know, success is just an amplifier of who you are.
That's probably right. I think there is also an old money versus new money phenomenon.
Oh, totally.
Too, where like, if you grew up with it, you're just sort of used to it. You don't have to be flashy and post all your Rolexes on Twitter, which I don't do, but a lot of people do.
Speaking of new money, you guys want to talk about Temu?
I want to talk about Temu, but just real quick on this governor thing. Dude, what is going on in Canada with the taxes, huh?
Oh, yeah, seriously.
I got Harley tweeting about it. I got you tweeting about it.
It's Canadians. Just like our country hates entrepreneurs. So what they've done, our capital gains tax here, it's called an inclusion rate. So you guys have like on all capital gains, right? I think you pay 20% capital gains tax. We've paid 50% of 50%. So half of your capital gain is included and taxable, and the other half is not. So it works out to like an effective tax rate of 25%. We've been this way for like decades and decades and decades. Up until Trump, we were actually a better capital gains tax. Like we had a better cap than the US did. And then Trump lowered it. Now, what our prime minister just did was he decided that it was unfair that normal income is 100% taxable, right? So he wanted to include more of capital gains as taxable income. So it basically raises our capital gains tax to an effective like 36%. So what it really does is it doesn't change the incentive, I don't think, for small business, which is what they're rightly arguing. They're not screwing with small business. Where Harley and Toby and myself are really pissed off is it does create a disincentive, at least a little bit, for people to take big swings. And Canada lacks entrepreneurs willing to go build big things. So like, if you're going to go and take a big swing, why would you do it in Canada when you can just go to the States and incorporate and set up there? And if you do win, you're paying 20% cap gains versus 36%. So I think there is more nuance to this, guys. I don't think everybody on the show is going to care, but it's frustrating for those of us in the country when we want to see our productivity go up. We want to see entrepreneurship go up. And none of that shit is looking good up here right now. And then they rolled out this and it was just like, great. So we're going in the other direction.
On the government kind of, you know, Jason, I need to figure out my platform here. We're talking about government. Here's the question. We'll kick around. If you were elected, you know, president or governor or whatever, you have the ability to change one law to make it more business friendly. What would be the law that you would change?
It's an impossible question because I think the first thing you do is you eliminate 50% of the people who work for the government. The bigger issue is that it's just this monstrosity of a machine and to pick one thing is really, really hard because I'm just going to pick whatever benefits me the most. And I just think tax rates are just way too high.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, and it's got a perverse effect.
I would agree. You know, it's funny. Like, I think I've gotten into this debate a lot, Mike, with my non-entrepreneur friends. And I think that until you go down this path of trying something very hard, it's really hard to have a respect or an understanding for the risk-reward balance that we all endeavor on, right? So I do think that disincentive is a real challenge. And I think that what I would do is I would do the opposite of what my government is currently doing. I would make it easier to start companies. I would make it like the reward balance much higher. You know, like if you're going to go out and be a net job creator for the economy, I would have every program available to do that. And in Canada specifically, like I really think our country lacks policy, especially around tax, but lacks policy in general. And then as a result, all the private sector infrastructure that comes with that policy to encourage entrepreneurs to try bigger things and harder things.
But having to cover this massive government spend, having to cover this massive bloated government, that's why the taxes are so
it's
high.
It's so dumb, man.
So that's where you have to go. I mean, it's absolutely.
I think it's irresponsible. I really do. Like, I know that other podcasts and other people talk about this right now in like Western civilization. Like, our governments are just spend crazy. I think we spend way too much money as like, you know, in America, in Canada, way too much money. I think government's better off staying out of most things. Like, I believe that. So like, if I could wave a magic wand right now in Canada, what we need is we need to really get back to being good entrepreneurs, really push innovation. Like it's a global economy and we are falling behind as a country. And it's all the data says that too. Like, that's kind of what I love about what Toby is doing is Toby is just highlighting the data. You know, like our public sector employment growth has been obscene the last 10 years and our entrepreneurship is just doing, it's
totally flat direction over like a 20 year period.
It's so bad. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that I would be most focused on. Now, that's my bias. Like Jason said, I am an entrepreneur. But I do think that that's where, like, as a country, that's where your competitiveness on the global stage is going to come from. And we are on a global stage. So I think it matters quite a bit.
All right. So look, Matt, why is everyone talking about Temu?
Okay. Let's switch gears to Temu, because I think the politics thing, I'm just going to get pissy. Temu's not going
to
make me happy.
It's a bad week. It's a bad week to talk about Canadian politics.
Yeah. I got taxed a lot more this week, so I'm not happy. Look, Temu, I've been like looking into this, and because I see it on Twitter, right? And it usually comes in the context of they're increasing ad costs for everybody else. But there's some things that I want to say a few things, and then I'd love to just get your read on this. And I've got some questions. So everybody knows Shein, right? Massive company. Temu has gotten to more users than Shein in 6 months. Like, it took Shein 8 years to get to the same level of users that Temu is. They are now the number one most downloaded app in the United States. They did that in just over a year. And what I find interesting, and I want to get your thoughts on this, is Temu seems to be a direct contrast, like on the other end of the spectrum than Amazon. Temu's bet is that people are willing to wait a long time for packages as long as those things are extremely cheap. Amazon has historically been all about delivery time, fast, free. Temu's sitting here saying 6 to 21 days, you know, but it's cheap. And the question I have is Temu right now, to the American consumer, which we all care about, are they creating a new set of sort of like market behaviors and expectations in the same way that Amazon did with free shipping and free return 20 years ago, which forced everybody else in the game to figure out if they could do it too? We still don't know if free shipping, free returns was actually a net positive to everything.
Like, right. So, yeah, I did it. Man, you want to take some people off, tell them that Amazon setting the expectation of free shipping in e-commerce was net bad for e-commerce, and you will kick a hornet's nest. I found that out on Twitter about a year ago.
Right. So like, what is Temu doing beyond ad costs, right? What, if we were to game theory this out, and just like look out over the next 5 years, they clearly have unlimited cash. They don't play the same game that every other brand and every other retailer has to, not even Amazon. Where is this going? Like, is this actually going to be good for customers, like the American customer? Like, is this good competition? Like, we're all free market capitalists here. Is this good competition, or is this actually anti-competitive at its core and, you know, it's going nowhere good?
I mean,
Mike?
It's totally unsustainable, is my take right now. Ryan Peterson wrote this. I thought it was interesting that last Q4, about 40% of the air freight was Chinese e-commerce sellers. This year, Flexport thinks it's going to be somewhere between 50 and 60%. So a ton of the stuff that's coming over on planes is Chinese e-commerce. And, you know, the bottom line is, there are a lot of loopholes that they're using. It isn't just that people are willing to wait the time. It's that mailing a package by air from China is really expensive. And they are finding ways, there are some ways where they're not having to pay the rates that you would usually pay, whether that's you're getting, you know, shipping that's lower than it should be, or you're not paying duties and tariffs due to exceptions or whatever else. And that feels unsustainable. Biden came out yesterday and said, I'm increasing tariffs on Chinese steel. Trump has said, if I get elected, I'm doing another, you know, 10 to whatever percent on top of everything. And so I think in some ways, if you look at what Temu is doing, it's really rational that they probably have a window that they need to absolutely maximize, because there's just going to be a point where people are going to come for them. I don't remember who said it this week, but said that they think Temu is a bigger threat than TikTok. One of the sitting congressmen said this.
And it was Tom Cotton, I think.
Yeah. We are heading into a period. I mean, like the thing that's interesting is there's so little that our country's politicians agree upon. And yet, they're pretty uniform in their opinion that China and China's economic economic competition with the U.S. is not good for us and needs to be stopped. Think about the Venn diagram of how much Biden and Trump agree upon. And it's like, well, that's a pretty small sliver, right? But apparently Chinese tariffs is in that little sliver, right? And so I don't see it as particularly sustainable. I mean, it feels like an arbitrage that's based around the rules of the system as they sit today. But if nothing else, you got to say, man, it has been awe-inspiring to see the level of scale and how, like you said, how quickly it's happened.
It's wild.
That, you know, I don't know. And, you know, I don't know what their economics are.
But right? Matt, you said they have unlimited funds. How is that?
Well, so they're part of, I think the parent company is called Pinduoduo or PDD, something like that, which is like a Alibaba, you know, like Alibaba and JD would be the other two big ones in China. And then PDD has kind of come out of nowhere in the last little while and just like eaten market share. What I mean by unlimited funds is that what I find interesting is that China is one of the few countries in the world right now that has still very much got the money machine going burr. Like it is just printing cash and rates are low. So we've talked on this pod about how as American companies, we can go to our factories because they still have access to cheap capital. But that's at our scale. Then I was thinking, I'm like, now at the scale of PDD and Alibaba, think of the cost of their capital in China. It's damn near zero, mm-hmm. which means if you were going to eat a market, like try to eat a market, that's a good place to be right now.
And we just don't know, you know, like, listen, it's not purely capitalism, right?
No.
There's all kinds of dark money that flows around behind the scenes. And, you know, Chinese accounting, even the public companies in China, it's notoriously unreliable, the accounting and the numbers that they're putting out. And so, you know, we don't know where all of the, you know, we don't know what Temu's economics are, and we don't know how much is being bankrolled potentially by the government. And all we know is that they have scaled up in a massive, massive way. Here's another thing, and I think this is non-trivial as well. I'll just use something from my industry. There was this whole thing in Q1 about lead in Stanley. And oh, wow, some insulated water bottles have lead. But you know what? Even the ones that had it, like, you know, Yeti uses the solder that has lead in it. Okay. But it's inside the bottle. It's capped. It's like you would have to like just absolutely be trying to get to that lead to have any exposure. And even then it wouldn't be enough to hurt you. And yet, every day with these Chinese e-commerce sellers, with some of the people selling on the Amazon marketplace, there is product that has basically no vetting for safety, that has lead in its paint, that has all kinds of chemicals being used. When we sell into, you know, like a Target or a Walmart, there's some pretty extensive testing you have to go through. And with all this other stuff, like it is the Wild West. And it really, maybe the thing that's going on here, one of the things that's going on here is that the American consumer is so fixated with cheap. I want to get more and I want to get it cheap. You know, even when they talk about, I want to buy in America, you give them a much cheaper good from overseas, they pick that. And they'll say they're really concerned with health and safety, but then they'll buy stuff that just does not have any kind of vetting. And I wonder if that window closes also. I wonder if there's some high profile cases where it's like, hey, you know, part of the way that thing that usually you pay $50, you bought it on Temu for $4 is because they took a shortcut. You know, they used a chemical in there, or they used, and like this stuff happens like right now, for sure. This stuff is happening. We just, people are just somewhat unaware. And I think that's another place where I could see political involvement is, that because it is kind of the Wild West and there aren't these filters, I can see the government using that as an excuse to, and generally I'm in agreement with what you said, Matt, like, I think the government generally makes things worse. I'm more of a free market guy. I think the market kind of corrects itself. But there are times when it's important for the government to step up. And there are certainly things that the government will use as an excuse to get involved. Man, it feels like a lot of those are present here.
Yes. So I was on Klaviyo. I was I just checked. I was paying over $15,000 a month for Klaviyo. And, you know, that is the most Shopify will charge you is $40,000 a month. So they were very quickly approaching half of my overall Shopify bill for just being built on Twilio. I mean, that's what, sorry, Cody. I know you're a Klaviyo believer, but that shit is just built on Twilio. And just so overpriced since it got public. They're just kind of move up market, went to Sendlane. My bill is down 80% plus. I mean, you're going to give up some features because they're a brand new company and they're building them out. Segmentation, they're working on it right now. But seriously, like, we're looking at cutting SaaS costs right now. And like, I saved $10,000 a month. That pays for an email manager. That pays for a graphic designer and an email manager. You should definitely think about leaving Klaviyo. It'll be a little bit harder. It'll be a little bit challenging. But can you imagine saving $100,000? In 2014, I made $20,000 a year. Okay, I worked an entire year 10 years ago and I made 20 grand. There's no way I'm giving an email provider $200,000 a year.
Is that when you were folding shirts at Abercrombie?
I probably worked at Brooks Brothers then. I was an intern at Brooks Brothers in 2014 or whatever. But dude, Abercrombie wouldn't hire me. Have you seen the way there's no way I'm getting an Abercrombie, dude. That was for the hot guys. You know, Connor worked at Hollister, so he could get it, not me though.
You know, Jason, I think one of the things that I find interesting in this is there has been a lot of talk on both sides of the aisle about tariffs. Trump, I don't know if you guys remember this, but Trump actually, there's this thing called the like United Postal Union or the Universal Postal Union globally. It's like a UN thing. And the loophole that, you know, Shein and Temu and the rest of them and TikTok are even working with right now is that the American taxpayer is literally paying for all the shipping, right? Because China takes advantage of this like developing nation status, which means its freight rates are not actual real freight rates. Like you and I, like Mike, you could not air freight a simple modern bottle from New York to LA for less money than they're going from China.
This is absolutely true.
And a lot of people don't realize that. A lot of brand operators don't realize that you're not competing on a fair market right now. They are able to ship something for like 60, 70, 80, 90% less than any one of us can by frickin' plane.
Like, and it doesn't make any sense. Doesn't make any sense that we wouldn't close that loophole. Like, that is a thing that's going to get shut down.
That's not a tariff though, right? This is actually like, so Trump actually, I remember actually being really thrilled with this. He wanted to withdraw from this treaty altogether, which allowed sort of like developing. And the funny thing is I could be wrong. So nobody kill me on this on social. I believe that nations create their own designation within the UPU. So like you can say, I am a developing nation. I'm not a developed nation. And the whole point of this was to create bridges between, you know, second and third world countries doing business with first world countries like the United States. And I think China, at least what I remember, again, don't fact check me on this. I do believe this is true, is that China was a developing nation. So they still get this favorable postal rate into the markets they want to compete in. So as I thought about, you know, this jam today, and Jason, I'm curious your thoughts on this. It's like, how do brands compete? You know, it just doesn't feel very free market capitalism at this point.
Well, we'll say competing with China in general or with Temu?
I think Temu, Shein, TikTok, like they're all playing this game. Like the number I saw was 600,000 packages per day, individual packages per day come in by air into the United States from China. From those three guys, that's it. Those three.
Well, and you can do some math, right? It's like, you know, your price, the U.S. is price subsidizing those at like $10 a pop. So it's like there's $6 million a day we're just giving to China. We're giving to China to beat us with, and that's not going to last. Like that's not sustainable. There's no way.
It's been going on a long time. So I just, you know, the whole point of capitalism is like competition's a competition is a good thing. Competition is better for the customer. And in an inflationary environment, which we've been in, you could make the argument that Temu and Shein and TikTok are driving prices down for the American customer. But are we thinking through the second and third order effects?
Yeah, look,
of this?
You can go on Shein and if you're and get your entire wardrobe if you're a woman. I don't even know if they sell men's, but I know they sell women's. Like,
yep.
You can get your entire wardrobe there for nothing, like for fractions. And so, and now Temu is just another like massively discounted or just super low price place to purchase goods. And it's just. We're just thinking about the laws of competition in general, and you just have to be better. And you can't try to apply like rational thinking to this. Like, oh, they're going to deal with this. The government's going to deal with this. Maybe they will, but they probably won't, because there's some financial incentive somewhere in Washington that, why do you think all these things are allowed to happen? I mean, because someone other than the average American is benefiting from it somewhere. Now, Trump, with his extremely nationalistic view of things, right? Populist view of things. Maybe he's the only one because he's not in anyone's pockets. But you know what? He talked a big game about it for his last administration, and like none of it happened. And I'm not like a Trump hater, and I'm not a MAGA hat wearer. Like, I'm just like a rational person that looks at things. And he made a lot of promises, and he did, you know, a few of them. I remember when all the tariff talk was going on, because this is before I joined Hexclad, but I was an advisor to Hexclad in like 2018, 2019. And when Trump was putting on tariffs, like, people were very concerned, and Trump's tariffs actually did not affect Hexclad, which was nice. It's interesting on the Chinese steel thing, because like, the United States essentially, I mean, we did this to ourselves, guys. The country did it to itself by, China was allowed into the WTO, and then corporate greed and finance and corporate finance basically pushed US corporations to outsource the manufacturing capability of the United States. And I love the fact that brands like Simple Modern and Ridge are trying to do this stuff in the US. We have looked at it. We continue to look at it. We will continue to look at it. Like, this, the steel that we need, things that we need, honestly, it ain't easy to get. And all these people, like all these other companies that say that they're being made in America, like a lot of what they're getting is being sourced from outside America and being assembled in America. But like fundamentally, if we're looking at these things with a lens of rationality. And what I'm saying is, sorry guys, like, you need to follow the money to really analyze and unpack any of these questions.
So maybe to shift our gear a little bit, I mean, the big question is, what does it mean? If you're in e-commerce, if you're in business, like, what does it mean? What are the implications? And I'll tell you one that's just so obvious, is that over the last 10 years with e-commerce, there's been a lot of what I would call kind of arbitrage tactics thinking, where it's like, oh, we find this one place where traffic's really cheap. And so I can kind of arbitrage that, and I can sell, you know, some random product, or I can take advantage of Meta being really effective at finding people. And, you know, I don't have to put the time into product and branding and organization building. I can just kind of spin something up that I drop ship. And I mean, even in the last few years, like, there've been points where, you know, people have been doing the same thing with TikTok and TikTok shops. And it's just like, there is no enterprise value there. There's not going to be money to be made there anymore. Like, if you're an American and you're like, oh, my value that I'm going to bring to the chain is I'm going to get a product from China, I'm not going to really add value in any other way, and I'm going to drive digital marketing, I'm going to drive people to it. It's like, man, good luck. You know, if you're not adding value in terms of product design, if you're not building a real brand, you know, if you don't bring operational excellence and capabilities to the table, like, there's no money. There's no money. I mean, Amazon has been putting in all these additional kind of expectations and fees on sellers. And I think that the consensus that's arising is that they're just raising the bar, basically. Like, that you just have to be able to succeed on the marketplace, you've got to have quite a bit more operational chops than you did 2, 3, 4 years ago. And so I think that's the message to anybody listening to this. When you build real valuable skills, and you add value to the chain, no matter what happens with the political situation, no matter what China does, you're always going to be able to create income and have a business. And if you don't, if you're relying on something very situational, or if you're arbitraging, you know, like, it, good luck. There's no way. It's not going to work over the next 5 years in the US.
Mike, you're 100% right about that. You're 100% right about that. You hit the nail on the head. Actually, it was sort of, I was going there and I got sidetracked. I don't know. Yelling about following the money, but you know, you're so right about that. All of these things, again, like, even in a down market, right, good businesses do well no matter what, and the bar just changes. I don't know if it's higher, it just changes.
I think changes is the right frame.
It's an ever evolving landscape, but it does start with adding value to your customer's life in some way. You have to do that. And any business that's not doing that is eventually going to suffer mightily.
Hmm. You know, the thing I've been thinking about on this Timu Sheehan TikTok, like, I've been thinking about not a ton, but just a little bit prepping for this jam session. Is this now the outsourcing of consumerism to China? So, like, we outsource manufacturing, right? But then manufacturing still meant the actual operating companies and the brands, like, everything was still here. Are we now just saying we're gonna see the outsourcing of the rest of it? So the companies don't need to be here anymore. There doesn't need to be distribution here anymore until this loophole is closed. It all is just gonna come direct from China, or like the cheapest possible market to make the thing is going to be where it comes from. And then the real thing I've been thinking about is, how does this impact retailers who are multi-brand marketplaces, right? Like the Walmarts and the Targets of the world. Like, Temu must be having an impact on those guys much more than I would say that, Jason, you might feel it on Hexclad, right? Like, this is really about commoditized, undifferentiated product. Like, Mike, that's what you're talking about, is we're exiting the Amazon private label era.
Yeah, I think so. Right? I think that I've said this before, but, you know, I'd like to think I know a lot about drinkware, and I mean, I know
more than most.
So much more than I did 8 years
drinkware
ago.
Drinkware,
right?
Or hydration.
Mike. Yeah, or hydration.
I right. love it. Yeah, I love the terminology.
Right, come on. Right. I would like to think I know a ton more. I mean, in some ways, I feel like I'm probably in a situation where I can know about as much as anybody in the world. And yet, man, if you said, okay, Mike, go start a brand from scratch in hydration on Amazon today, the way that you did in 2016, I'd be like, I don't know. I don't think I can do it. You know, like, certainly not at any kind of scale. It's a different game. And there is something to be said for being aware of just when the market is favorable to something and when the kind of winds have shifted. And so we're in a phase where, like you said, Matt, like the Amazon private label, like, hey, just show up, find, you know, get one of the tools, find a key term that has a lot of, you know, search volume and, you know, profit. Like, that's just not how it goes anymore. Like, you talk to people that are really thriving, and they are sophisticated operators. And I've said this before, but it's worth saying again. You've got to have at least like one thing, and usually it's a suite of things that you are just exceptional at, that you are able to somehow get way above market performance. And what we have learned is that there's actually a lot of different things that can be. That it doesn't mean you have to be great at digital marketing. For example, there's probably, I could probably name 10 or 20 different superpowers that I've seen from founders, but you got to have some kind of superpower, because the world is just, I say this to students that I teach all the time. It is easier than ever to start a digital business. The total like outcome and a total addressable market with digital businesses is bigger than it's ever been. They can scale up. I mean, I started one with my brother that went from $0 to $1 million in daily revenue in 13 months. Like, that is crazy. The internet makes that possible, but it also makes it just a massive meritocracy where you're competing against people all over the world. And if you don't have some kind of superpower that you're leaning on, then like, you are going to be toast. And so we probably do a disservice to people anytime we frame e-commerce as being easy. This might be one of the hardest ways you can possibly make money, but the offset of that, the benefit is when you win, it feels like magic. Your upside is so big because of the fact that it's digital, because of its scalability, but the scalability is exactly what makes it so hard. So anyway, like, we're in a hyper-competitive age of e-commerce. There's no reason to think that it's going to get less. There's no reason to think that digital advertising gets less expensive over the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Right? You know that Shopify has this thing about like arming the rebels. The problem is when everybody has the exact same armament, you know, you've lowered the bar so much. And I think most of the low-hanging fruit arbitrage is disappearing, which I think, Mike, is what you're talking about. Which I do completely agree with. And I also, I think you hit on something that's really important for people to hear, which is there are many ways to create and generate leverage in a business, like many, many ways. You know, and your goal as an operator is to try to stack up as many of those as possible to create something that's unique to you. So, you know, audience, Kevin from Epic Gardening has this concept called negative CAC. It's like, make more money from my media than I pay in acquisition costs for my commerce business. Like, what a cool ass idea that is. So you're seeing that with like all these creator led brands. They basically have negative CAC. There's margin leverage, you know, like Ridge benefits from margin leverage. Crazy high margins can make like lots of room for error and can run the business incredibly low to the ground. Mike, you know, what's fascinating to me is your business does not have margin leverage, like from a gross margin perspective.
No, it doesn't.
You never have, but you've made it work without gross margin leverage. And I think it's, that would be like typical e-commerce dogma is you can't do it without 70, 80% gross margins. Right. And you're the actual flip of things.
Well, and here's why, you know, like, I think this is where you have to have a good assessment of yourself and like, what's that superpower? Like, we can sell our faces off. Right? We've got unbelievable relationships with Amazon, with Target, with Walmart, with Costco, you know, and it goes on and on. Some of our people were in Seattle this week, and the reps we have on our 1P Amazon account were basically like, we've got good news and bad news. Basically, the good news is you're considered so strategic an account and a brand to Amazon at this point that like upper leadership asks about you a lot. And they're like, the downside of that is if there's anything, you know, like if your fill rates aren't very good, like literally executives at Amazon know about it and care about it. But we had to be able to sell like crazy. And that was something that I realized early on in the company that I could do. I could go in a room, I could paint a compelling picture, and I could have somebody buy into what we were building and the value proposition. And so like you said, there's a multitude of different ways that you can leverage your skills to build something valuable, but you're going to have something. One other kind of point that's worth making here. Basically, the internet is an opportunity where you can go really big. You can go for the really big outcome. And we never had margin structure, margin leverage, but we had huge TAM. And that's allowed us, the ability to sell in huge TAM has allowed us to kind of circumvent the fact that we don't have the traditional margins that you think you need to make e-commerce work. For most people, the key to being successful in e-commerce is going to be finding a really, a very specific niche where you can go in and you can do it better than anybody else, right? Like I collect antique Shogun swords from, 700 years ago, and I am the best person on the internet. If you want to buy one of those, and I sell these swords for $5,000 because there's a small community that this means a big deal, and I'm the resident expert. You know, I share this rare plant that only grows in Bolivia, but there's enthusiasts all over the world that want to be able to buy it, and I'm the one place you can get it. And you know, what we're really talking about when we talk about that is that you're creating a moat of a sort of being an expert and being the best at something.
Well, really you're talking about, Mike, is creating a sustainable competitive advantage in your business, right, Matt? Like that's what this is about. And when, you know, everyone who goes to business school studies this stuff, what are the competitive advantages? You can have a first mover advantage. You could have a low cost provider advantage, which is kind of like what we're talking about here. You could have a really proprietary product as a competitive advantage. You could have just a really super powerful brand positioning as a competitive advantage. You need to have one of those. Like you need, there's others, but you need to have one of these competitive advantages to be successful. Otherwise, it's just like whatever you have is going to get arbitraged away.
You know, and what Mike is saying, Jason, to that is, which I think is interesting, is the whole, you guys have always heard this term, like the riches are in the niches. You know, we might just be seeing the, like the hyper fragmentation of consumer goods, where because of it's so easy to do all of these things, we might just now see the way to compete might just be the extreme niche down version of everything. You know, like I think the Pila case is probably even a good example of this. Like we created a compostable plant-based phone case. Like the market, you know, the broad market probably wasn't asking for that, but we found like 2 million people globally who want it. You know, that's the message they actually wanted.
Yeah, we love Northbeam. The longer I operate in this role at Hexclad, the deeper and deeper and the more things we're using Northbeam for. So we use it for the reason Northbeam was initially created, for their multi-touch attribution to inform channel level and intra-channel performance and optimization decisions. But more recently, we're really loving Northbeam's media mix modeling solution to inform our overall media mix. They've created multiplier data for us. So, you know, we can plug in our blended metrics, our blended goals, and understand roughly where we need to be inside of each channel to hit those blended metrics. So it's become a really nice pulse check at the channel level. So yeah, Northbeam's becoming this, you know, truly all-in-one attribution tool, and it's core to our day-to-day decision-making.
So I used this example recently, but I think it's a great illustration of what you're talking about, Matt. Here's what the internet does. In the traditional way that things were sold throughout basically all of human history, it was like where you physically located, and that creates the bounds on kind of what you can sell. So if you live in a small town, right, you have to go fairly lowest common denominator with everything you sell. We sell hammers because almost everybody in the town needs a hammer, but we don't sell like 50 different types of hammers because we don't have enough people for us to need that kind of variety of selection. If you go to like New York City, you get a different thing, or even better, let's go to Tokyo. If you go to Tokyo, you see that they have an incredible diversity of retail shops. You'll see things like, oh, wow, that's a shop that sells, you know, records, vinyl records from the 80s. It's like, wow, that's so specific. How do you ever sustain a shop like that? And the answer is simple. There's just so many people that the larger the number of people, the more niched down you can get, right? The internet is like the classic example of this, that the internet unlocks billions of people, and it kind of erases this geographic piece for most products. And all of a sudden, you can take a product. So for example, Pila case, you know, let's say there's 2 million people in the world that want a Pila case, that it matters to them that there's a compostable case, right? Well, if you think about 2 million people as a fraction of 8 billion people, it's not particularly big. Right? Like that's saying like one in every 4,000 people cares about this. So, okay. So if you live in a town that has 100,000 people, you would have 25 potential customers. Can you open up a retail establishment with 25 potential customers? No, of course not. That's ridiculous. But with the internet, all of a sudden, you can aggregate all those people, right? They might be distributed across the United States and Canada and internationally, but now you can aggregate them. And that 2 million people, like, that's a really significant number of people, and you can build a significant business. And this is the miracle and the power of the internet, is the ability to aggregate people regardless of geography around around their interests and around the things that they want to buy. And that's when you most powerfully leverage the internet. When you say, I'm going to sell the same hammer as Lowe's, but I'm going to sell it on the internet, good freaking luck. You're not even leveraging the tool effectively. But when you say, hey, you know what? There's like 50,000 people in the world that want my special diamond hammer, you know, that was, you know, handcrafted by somebody in the Swiss Alps, and it's the best hammer ever for all these reasons, you know, and there might be, you know, one person like that in my town that wants this hammer, but across the world, there's 50,000. Boom. That's the use case for e-commerce. I'm convinced. So you're wanting to look for opportunities like that, unless, you know, in most categories, you know, Jason's selling pans. Okay, that's different. That's super wide. And we represent, I think, kind of people who have in very mass categories who have made it work. But for most people, like, what they need to hear from us is, like, that takes a lot of luck and is hard to replicate. It'd be hard for us to even maybe replicate. And instead, look at how do you create these sustainable competitive advantages and create a business that uniquely leverages what the internet can do.
Yeah, man, I think you know, I think the question that most people are asking right now with respect to Temu and Shein and this rise of this new type of competition is, how difficult and how expensive is it going to be? Like, what's rent going to be like to reach all of these global customers? You know, that's really what we all pay, right? We pay Facebook rent and Google rent and, you know, TikTok rent. That's our digital rent. And when you get these big players that come in, and you saw this with physical retail, right? Like, you know, Walmart could show up and pay a lot more for rent than the local guy. Are we also entering that phase of things? And then that's going to say, like, yes, you need to focus on some subset of customers with some subset of problems. That's your path to build a business. The size of the TAM, that's, you know, a separate question altogether. But then what is the best way to actually reach those people? And I think there's just a lot of question marks in the market right now around where is that all going? You know, like, if players can show up and just spend gobs of money, you know, for how long? And that, I think that's the big question. I don't know what you guys feel there, but, you know.
I just think what we know is, in historically, we haven't seen somebody come out and hyperscale like this and it be sustainable. I've used this analogy before, that, like, the way that Roundup kills plants is actually counterintuitive. It makes the plant grow itself to death. And, like, it's kind of funny. It confuses the cells in the plants and it tells them replicate, 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 and the plant dies. And that, you know, there is tremendous risk, we've talked about before, when you grow at this rate. And so you look at how much they've scaled and how quickly it's gone, and you're like, well, gosh, what are other examples I can think of? And especially if you look in the e-commerce world, you start listing them out and it's like, there's a lot of cautionary tales of the people that scaled up super, super fast.
Yeah, dude, for sure.
Yeah, Sean Lowe's pointing him out on his Twitter.
That's true. Sean's the reporter for D2C. Any final thoughts on this before we wrap? This has been good. You guys have got me thinking.
Well, I think that if you're a brand owner, you're focusing on brand and you're also wanting to protect it from knockoffs. Something that we've started doing. This is actually kind of crazy. So I was introduced by one of our friends. Who was it? I think it was Aaron from Zule Home. He introduced me to this legal team that basically they look for infringers, and then they have a very unique way of kind of cutting these guys off at the knee. And we started working with them, and they've been out there, like, scouring the internet basically for, like, people infringing on our trademarks or our brand. And they sent us the final report of, like, here's everybody we're going to go after. And again, they have a unique way of going after them where they get a judgment and they use that judgment to get them kicked off of Alibaba. And that kind of brings them to their knees where they come to the table. Whereas usually they'd be like, I'm not paying you. Anyway, so they sent us this report of like all the infringers, and I'm like, okay, we'll see how good these guys are. You know, is it like three lines in the Excel spreadsheet, or, you know, is it 20 or what is it? There were 2,000 lines in this spreadsheet of infringers they found. I mean, it was like, wow, you guys are, so they're going to go after a whole slew of people. And I do think that's an important part of brand management. If you are building something of value, that for sure, you know, places like Temu, I was actually just searching, and I was pretty pleased if I searched Simple Modern and Simple Modern Tumblr and stuff like that on Temu. You don't get any stuff that's infringing, or maybe there was one that was kind of close at this point. But and so you've got to be pretty proactive in protecting your IP.
Very cool.
Yeah, we actually, you know, it's funny you mentioned knockoffs and infringers and stuff like that. We've always had that. We've always had a lot of knockoffs. We have a number of patents, but people can be pretty creative, and we go after them, and a lot of cease and desist letters and stuff. But it's sometimes just hard to even get to these people.
Yep.
But it's been particularly bad lately. And it's funny, you know, we're so big now that it's like we've crossed into this new territory where it's almost like everyone is coming after us now. Mike, do you feel that way? Or just because there's a number of other like big players in hydration, that you're going toe to toe with some names that we talk about, like Hard. There are plenty of big players in cookware too, but like, I just feel like there's something that happened where Hexclad has just become like so renowned for our success in some respects. I don't know why. I mean, we're still like a pimple compared to a lot of other companies, but like it's just coming at us fast and furious these days. It's pretty interesting.
Well, I think, you know, to go back to our idea of moats and competitive advantages, here's what we know about people. We know that if they see something that seems to really be working, then especially entrepreneurial types immediately start to think about, how could I get some of that? How could I steal some of that market share, and immediately start to try and come after it? And you guys have been one of the most successful D2C brands, you know, since D2C has existed, but especially of the last few years. So it's not surprising that people are going to come after that. This is why moats matter. They will come. They will come and try and storm the castle. Do you have a way to keep them out? Do you have ways to protect yourself? And that can take a lot of different forms. But one of the things that when I work with like students that want to be entrepreneurs or people that are in the business plan kind of phase, I'm like, you should start thinking about moats in the business plan phase. Because coming up with an idea, usually what people do is they say like, oh, will this work? I'm going to try and kind of generate an idea. And can I make money doing it? And then we teach them, okay, then you go and you go out in the market and you validate it. And if it works, you scale it up. But here's the problem. It's not worth starting something that you can't defend, right? There's nothing, I don't know if you guys have had this experience. I certainly have, where I started something and there was initial traction and I poured a bunch of time into it. And then I realized it wasn't sustainable and I didn't make any money off of it. And so I would advise to everybody, if you're not actively daily thinking about your business and how would it be attacked, how would people come at it, what are the ways that you can defend it from people, then you know you're vulnerable to being disrupted. And when you do have success, just like Jason's experiencing, just like Matt and I have experienced, Sean too, that they will come. So be thinking about that as early as you can.
They will come for everything and from everywhere. It's like, it's crazy.
It's a thousand of them.
You know, when you're talking about really, if you have a moat, and look, we have an awesome moat, so I'm not worried about it. And now we, on top of a great product, we also have a great brand that's known for quality and innovation. So I'm not worried about it. But it is funny, you know, we have a lot of young people in our company. And every time we see something, it's like everyone's sending it around and, oh, what's this? And, oh, what's that? And it's like, just relax, you know, it's going to be just fine. Like you said, we've built the moat. But if you don't, like to your point, Mike, if you don't think, you've got to think about building the moat before you're successful.
Absolutely.
Because it could be too late. Meaning the protection that you need. So you need to be thinking about that. And that's actually hard to do, right? Because most people are reactive and not proactive. And so it's just by nature, because you're just doing so many things. This is an area to be really proactive about, like from the beginning, even if you don't think you have it, like you have to plan on it. You have to plan for it, and you have to do whatever it takes and talk to all the right people to protect yourself that way.
What's one area where you would have been more proactive, Jason, if you could go back and talk to the team 3 years ago, 5 years ago? What's one thing you would tell them to be more vigilant about, or to focus more attention and resources?
Well, one thing is I would be really super proactive about like any document that you sign. It's very easy for someone to send you a document with some boilerplate and just like sign it and send it. Oh, whatever. I'm never going to get into a fight with these. I could think of 3 or 4 documents that were signed at HexCloud, some of which I fucking signed, and I'm a lawyer. That I want to take myself out to the woodshed about. And there's a bunch that I didn't sign, but there's at least one that I did. And so that's a simple thing, but it's a really, really easy thing to screw up. It's like really, really read anything that your company is putting their signature on, because there's stuff buried in that, their language, and you got to be super careful.
That's such good advice, man. That is so good. Love it. Is that the pod?
That's the pod.
That's the pod.
That's the pod. We got to how to skip my panzerism. I'll save it for the next one. It's great to see you, boys. Sorry, Sean, you missed it today, buddy.
He's on the elliptical. Sean's getting in shape. He'll be back next week.
All right, boys.
All right, guys, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks for joining us for episode 53. Special thanks to our sponsors, Northbeam, Synlane, and Fulfill. Thanks for all you do in making the pod possible. We'll see you guys next week.